This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Deborah and Ken Ferruccio are unlikely saviors. They moved to North Carolina in 1977 looking for some peace and quiet, but a year later, the state announced plans for a landfill in Warren County where they lived. The landfill would hold 60,000 tons of soil contaminated with highly toxic chemicals called PCBs. Deborah and Ken didn't buy the government's assertion that the landfill would be safe, so they jumped into action. But they had no idea that their struggle would last years and help launch the environmental justice movement. We have Deborah and Ken Ferruccio in the studio today. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank, for having us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You moved to Warren County in 1977. How did you first hear about the landfill?
Well, it's December 8th. It's December of 1978. Of course, there'd been a lot of talk about it because it was the largest American, largest PCB spill in American history. There was a lot of speculation on how they were going to solve the problem. And I believe, Deborah, they originally went to Chatham, didn't they?
Yeah, maybe you can back up just a bit and tell us about that spill.
Okay. Frank, what happened was in the summer of 1978, in late July and August, for nearly 2 weeks, in the dark of night, these different gentlemen, a man and his sons, spewed PCBs along some 220 miles of road. We're never sure about the numbers. In 14 counties, and they had done it previously in June at Fort Bragg. So immediately there was a public health crisis. The state put up signs like about every quarter of a mile, big yellow signs that said caution, you know, PCB along the roadsides. And then the state government was in the position to have to do something about it. Coincidentally, that same week that the PCBs were being dumped, the Toxic Substance Control Act went into effect, which specifically legislated what to do with PCBs. So, and that same week also, coincidentally, Love Canal residents were being evacuated from their homes. So the public was very aware of the dangers of chemicals. And here these guys illegally drip all these chemicals, noxious, terrible smelling chemicals that made people sick, nauseous, skin problems immediately.
And this wasn't an act. They're trying to get rid of this stuff before the regulations go into effect so that they're not to pay all this
Yeah,
money.
That's, I mean, that's
this is
what we—
a deliberate that, effort. They went to jail.
They went to jail for a minimal amount of time on federal charges, not state charges. But meanwhile, the PCBs are lying on the roadsides. And in Warren County, we should have known, but we didn't. They picked up a temporary test mile and put him in a landfill in Warren County. That was within a few weeks afterwards. And so life goes on, and the people next to the roads, their life does not go on normally. They're walking through them. Their kids are standing in the buses. You know, they're living with them. And then, as Ken said, we learned about the actual landfill, what the state was going to do with this in late December, right before Christmas, when we heard that the state intended to bury the PCBs regardless of the public sentiment. Well, that set off a powder keg in Warren County because not only did toxic PCBs seem really dangerous, we didn't know a lot about them at first, but nobody likes to be told that you don't have any say in your future. So we did what most people would do. We got the facts. We educated ourselves. And we had to prepare for a public hearing that was going to be right after New Year's, in which the state was going to present its plan to the EPA, and they would then approve it. So we had very little time, and in that time, the community did sort of the unheard of, and we got 700 to 1,000 people to a hearing and held the state there till 3 in the morning as people all said what they believed, and this was also based on science. We hired a scientist who did test borings, who found out the site was not suitable, and so we didn't just react, you know, we don't want this just in our backyard, and this is emotional. We were alerted to the fact, oh my gosh, this is going to be a bad plan. So we met with the governor soon after. We went to the EPA. We had them describe to us how the regulations were changing, because at first they were going to need 3 out of 5 waivers to get the site. Mm. But when they changed regulations, they didn't. The new regulations made it all okay without the waivers.
Well, let's talk about this for a second, because it's an interesting problem. It's not as though somebody drives into Warren County with several hundred barrels of this stuff and says, hey, we would like to build a dump in your county to put these barrels of stuff. it was already on the ground. And so the state does have a kind of a problem now. This stuff is already in the environment. We're going to scoop it up, but now what? And then they said, that's when they made the announcement, we're putting it here. And the startling announcement from a state official, we don't care what people say, we're putting it here.
Yeah, I think my involvement begins with that statement. And it went something like, you know, the state of not... public sentiment will not deter the state from constructing a landfill for the burial of the PCBs. And I just couldn't understand it because I thought, well, you know, public sentiment is the very cornerstone of democracy. And if you've got sound science and sound technology, the people are reasonable and they'll listen. But to preempt the public sentiment and from that suggest that the decision was already made, a fait accompli. I thought that whenever a government makes a statement like that, you've got to respond. So I wrote a letter to the editor of the One Record, reaffirming that public sentiment is the very cornerstone of democracy. You know, the will of the people expressed through their public sentiments is apparently what America is supposed to be all about. And I also took a stand. You know, I said I stand on 1.56 acres of land that Mr. and Mrs. Hoskins sold to Deborah and me. And a lot of people, I think, since then thought that I was a NIMBY, a not-in-my-backyard kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, what I was saying is that I was standing on everybody's 1.56. I was standing on the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. So that is basically how I became involved in it. And then several days later, we went to a meeting in Warren County, and we formed Warren County Citizens Concerned About PCBs. And for whatever reason, the people chose me to be the spokesman for the group. Deborah, you want to say
they
something?
Chose you for this as a spokesman, Ken, because you sent press statements to the Associated Press as well. He just took command and had never been involved in politics like this, but. Ken's a man of letters and always gets down to basics, and he did. And the people of this community who might not have felt confident with a Yankee outsider who'd only lived among them for a year could be their spokesperson. Well, but he won the hearts of people in the county.
Let's talk about those Yankee outsiders and your intentions. It really, you were stirred by this comment because you didn't come down here to become active in politics. What brought you to North Carolina?
Frank, I grew up with teachers. My parents were teachers, so we got to do a lot of traveling in the summer, including visiting state and national parks all over. And North Carolina was the place we came back to the most, to the Outer Banks and to the mountains. And so when Ken and I had the opportunity that very cold winter of 1977 when there was an energy crisis and President Carter said that energy problems were the moral equivalents of war, we moved south. And we had met friends through a series of sort of accidents that have sort of tied Ken and me to the Episcopal Church. He grew up Catholic. I grew up Methodist. And we meet a fellow teacher at the Outer Banks, and she introduces us to some folks from Warren County, and we join the Episcopal Church. And as our relationship grew with the church, we became part active with the diocese. And as we later had to clean up our failed landfill, we began to try to coalesce people in the ecumenical and the environmental communities, and they were really helpful in helping us make the moral argument that we have to protect God's creation and people's public health because it's what God wants us to do. And basically, we have continued as educators to know that our job is to raise the consciousness. One time, we had the opportunity through the Episcopal Church minister to see Bishop Tutu, hear him speak. And afterwards, Ken got to ask Bishop Tutu a question, and he said, you know, given that in the United States, we often take high-risk facilities and put them in poor and often minority communities. What should we do? And in his beautiful, lilting voice, Bishop Tutu said, your job is to raise the consciousness.
And was that when you got here, though? Again, it really wasn't for that reason.
It was to raise the consciousness in our classroom. We're teachers.
So you did come to North Carolina with the intention of teaching and talking about environmental justice?
No.
We didn't know anything about environmental.
You're coming down here to live.
We came down here to grow a garden, to raise children eventually, I like to paint. Ken likes to write. We thought we'd live this sort of quiet, aesthetic life down our a mile road down to our log cabin. But instead, we found we had picked the crosshairs. The Afton community is where the landfill is of this environmental justice situation that would, you know, dominate the next 30 years of our lives.
You get started. You decide you have to do something. You write a letter. You call a meeting. At what point did you realize you were really at the helm of something that was going to...
It was when I returned from the meeting in Warren County after we organized Warren County Citizens Concerned About PCBs. And I'd been talking to Chip Pearsall, who was then with the News and Observer. I'd been talking with a lot of folks, but Chip knew we were going to have a meeting. And I get back to the cabin, and Chip was on the phone. He said, "Ken, what are you going to do if the state of North Carolina goes forward and attempts to implement the plan?" And I said, "Chip, it will be due process first, then civil disobedience. There can be no question about that." And as most folks, a lot of folks know, that's how it played out. We had 4 years of due process of law. We had three law cases, NACP, county government, and adjoining landowner. And as Deborah said, we began to educate the community through a research effort. And basically the research effort was obviously to try to find out whether or not the state's plan would be conducive to environmental and democratic sustainability. I mean, that's really what it was all about.
Tell you what, we'll take a break right here. When we come back, continue our conversation with Deborah and Ken Ferruccio and find out how environmentalism and social justice became environmental justice when our conversation continues. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking with Deborah and Ken Ferruccio and their struggle to prevent a landfill from being put in Warren County in the late 70s. Landfill is full of highly toxic chemicals called PCBs. So tell us what the state is telling you about how safe it's going to be when this thing gets built.
Well, the state's argument was that the engineering principles of landfill technology could transform an unsafe site into a safe site. And our scientist was saying basically that no, that can't be done in Warren County, North Carolina. We don't have the clay. We're about 5 to 7 feet from groundwater. And even if you could compact the clay to the EPA criteria of 1 × 10⁻⁷ centimeters per second or whatever it is, you couldn't do it. And the backup systems, the plastic liners and the leachate collection systems and the monitoring wells and all of that could not transform this site into a safe site for PCBs or for any kind of toxic or hazardous waste. So you had the thesis and you had the antithesis, and they were two diametrically opposed and irreconcilable positions. And that's how it started.
And so the state then asked for waivers, right?
Yes.
Right. At first, the regulations would have required a waiver because one of the main regulations that would have affected this particular site was there was a 50-foot distance. We later met with the EPA people who wrote these regulations, and they said, "We came up with 50 feet because we just had to come up with something that would keep this stuff right off of the water table."
Right. So you had to be 50 feet from the water table.
Right. And so...
And you were in Warren County, you're 5 feet, right?
Well, 5 to 7 feet.
So we thought
by that regulation we were going to be okay.
Well, that was also, that distance was not measuring how water fluctuates and it didn't necessarily do the high water level. Mm-hmm. And so what we found out was that the people of Warren County, which is one of the poorest counties in the state, undereducated, used common sense. And when we listened to the state and the EPA's description of what they could do with the landfill, you had well diggers and farmers said, "You have got to be kidding. You cannot dig a hole, put a piece of plastic in it, and keep this out." And so they were not expecting the intelligent response, because not only did we just use common sense, but since we had a scientist who came in and studied the soil and saw what the actual site was like, he said they couldn't have picked a worse site, even on the piece of property they had. They put it right exactly between two tributary creeks that go into Fishing Creek that go on down to the Pamlico Sound. So the point was that they could make this argument, and they thought they could get away with making it in a poor community without having a lot of political and legal repercussions. And so and one of the reasons the state official could say they were going to do it regardless of public sentiment, we later learned, was written into the TSCA regulations that govern PCBs, is the fact that you don't have to have public participation when it comes to the burial of PCBs. It's the only chemical that is separated. So they actually knew they had the federal legal backing for that. And when they saw that there was going to be a fight from Warren County by 1981, 2 years into the fight, the State General Assembly passed the Waste Management Act, which really solidified the opportunity for businesses and waste industries to come into North Carolina with the blessing of the governor if necessary, because it's written in that act that the governor can override local sovereignty. So these laws were like creating a green light. And, of course, after this, we had to immediately after Thermal Chem, an incinerator, hazardous incinerator company, tried twice to get into North Carolina. North Carolina was put in as the host to the Southeast Nuclear Compact, which took another 10 more years to get out of. And it was also targeted for numerous huge solid waste landfills. Now, why was all this waste moving toward North Carolina? Because if the federal laws were loose and they said state by state, you can do what you think is important as long as you meet our minimal ones, our state ones were also minimal, and enforcement, as we saw over the years, was minimal as well.
So you started the struggle in the courts. Tell us about the court battle, the legal fight.
Well, the court battles really were not that significant, really. What was significant was were the 4 years of research that we did. And out of that research emerged three concepts that led to the concept of environmental justice. That would be, of course, environmental justice, environmental civil rights, and environmental racism. Of course, justice is really the conformity to standards. And we were looking for the standards to conform the plan to, and we couldn't find them. We went to the Federal Register, as Deborah talked about, and we found that the regulations concerning landfills were very, very minimal, and that there were procedures for waiving them. So it looked, by studying those regulations, it looked as if the EPA was either deliberately or inadvertently shifting the basis for siting landfills from scientific and political considerations to from scientific considerations to basically political considerations, and therefore it seemed to me that they were basically preempting the environmental rights of targeted communities. And then, as Deborah mentioned, state waste management legislation, that seemed to be preempting civil rights because, again, the democratic process for targeted communities was basically preempted. The decision was made prior to public hearings. Public hearings, but they had a purely cosmetic function. Sovereignty rights of the targeted community were preempted, and force was authorized as needed. So if you looked at the EPA seeming to preempt environmental rights and then the state seeming to preempt civil rights, you had the concept of environmental civil rights.
A concept, but not a concept necessarily in the mind of those who were most affected. The idea of civil rights and environmental justice or environmental rights being linked. You know, there's that famous quote of Tom Bradley, who would become the mayor of Los Angeles, yeah, an African-American, but in 1972 on the city council saying, the environmental movement is about as popular to 20 million African-Americans as a segregated bus. That was 1972, Tom Bradley.
That's right. Yeah.
How did you get this idea linked in the minds of African-American leaders here? And remember Warren County, one of five counties with a majority African-American population. How did you make the link?
You know, one of the things that's so fascinating about Warren County is that even though it has been the poorest county with a high minority count, it was once the richest county, and that was pre-Civil War. But what Warren County citizens have had is this incredible relationship underneath it between blacks and whites. And so we were able to do something, Ken and me and this community, particularly of Afton residents, who we just dug in and did what people did. We literally ripped up the phone book and said, you take this page, you take this page, you take this page. And there was never a question from the beginning that you're black and I'm white.
Now, or being outsiders, that didn't
work. Or being outsiders, because when you have the gun to your head, you don't say, I don't really like you to help me. You'll take whomever. But we had already become friends with Mary Hinton Carr. Her husband was the senator. If it hadn't been for her, we wouldn't have gotten our log cabin. We knew Shine and Gid and all these local farmers. We knew the people from all walks of society. I guess it's because we're teachers, and that's just the way we are. And so this phenomenal response from the people is what joined it. And what was happening was the people of the community – there's a church there called Coley Springs. It's an African-American church. So we began to meet in the churches. And when we met in the churches and even at the courthouse, always every meeting began with prayer. So we did what civil rights people had always done, which was speak about politics in the church. And we did this even in our Episcopal church as much as was, you know, possible. So because people had faith that this was an issue that had a higher calling, and we were often speaking in the context of a church, we made people feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And they realized that what they were doing was something spiritual. And when they marched down to that landfill, knowing we were not stopping the trucks, but that we were taking a stand, it was a spiritual issue. And there was singing, and there were prayers. Reverend White carried, Reverend Leon White with the United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice, he carried the Bible. He's saying the 23rd Psalm as he's coming straight up on the highway patrol. He's running down negotiating with them. And so what we had done was we had gotten the people, and they inspired the civil rights leaders to come in. The civil rights leaders, Dr. Joseph Lowery from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and other leaders that came through there, they were inspired because the people had made this environmental movement a spiritual concern and a civil rights concern. Because civil rights was always a spiritual concern.
Right. And there was civil disobedience now. The courts, as you say, failed. The law was mostly on their side at this point. So tell us about how those demonstrations went and the acts of civil disobedience.
The litigation, in a sense, failed. But it's important to understand that the NAACP took out a case. And we had not only scientific and technological issues, but we had the 13th and 14th Amendment rights. And people knew about it because they were educated to these issues. Because of the 13th and 14th Amendment, obviously the wording went something like this: whenever you cite, regardless of the racial makeup of the community, actually, but this was, of course, a racial situation, that whenever you cite, you segregate that community, you reduce it to a condition of involuntary servitude, to waste management facilities destructive to persons and properties. So you had, involuntary servitude, the 13th Amendment, you had protection of persons and properties, the 14th Amendment, and people put it all together and realized that there were constitutional issues here that they felt were being violated. So they understood, I think, intellectually the need to stand up and fight. Also, by that time, they understood that waste management facilities simply recycled the waste back into the environment. They had the consensus of the scientific community was that, the containment principle continues to fail. EPA had come out in its Federal Register and said they can't build a landfill that won't leak. All landfills will eventually leak, and it's just a question of time, and so therefore they should be used only as stopgap measures. There was a study by Peter Montague in New Jersey looking at four EPA-approved hazardous waste landfills, and they all had failed to meet the expected performance criteria. So by the time the trucks rolled, the people were pretty much educated on these issues. They knew they had to take a stand. They had to take a constitutional stand. And, of course, they had to protect the environment. And so I think if we learned anything from this, it's that it's very difficult to make an argument that the industrial model is compatible with democratic and environmental sustainability. You can't really construct a moral argument for the proliferation of landfill technology without creating an ethic that would justify the destruction of the state itself. And I made that point clear the night before the trucking. And I simply said that because of this, all law-abiding citizens who would be out there the following morning, either stopping trucks or in jail having tried. So there was an awful lot of education that, you know, that put it together.
And describe that day for us, because in the end, I think 550 people were arrested, right?
Right. I was going to say, when you ask people to march 2 miles down a road, and it was hot those days, and they have to get off work, convince their bosses that they're not radical, find babysitters, all the things, the logistics of what make activism happen, all of those happen because of the inspiration that came to the people through this knowledge. And so we had to march down to that landfill, Ken leading along with Leon White and another minister, Reverend Jarboe, who lost his position over this later. We marched down there and didn't really know what was going to happen, but we knew as we went down there and Reverend Leon had the Bible open, it was going to be nonviolent. Nobody was going to throw any rocks. We were not going to be accused of being crazy people because we were not crazy.
I'm going to stop you right there because the there we're describing now is what? The trucks, the beginning of construction of the site?
No, the there, I'm sorry, when we marched down, we marched to the landfill site the first day as the first trucks are picking up PCBs that are going to be delivered and buried into that landfill. So we went down there and it was unbelievable. The support of the people who couldn't get arrested were signing their property to get us out of jail. They were throwing food over the chain link fence to us because they had not prepared at all how to feed all these, you know, protesters. And so that momentum built up in the next day, and we would meet every day before before the marches, and every night afterwards at Coley Springs Church. And we would revive in the people that energy that it takes to get up and go and do this again, because we had to pull this off. They thought we would do this maybe 2 or 3 days, a week at the most, but we had to pull this off for 6 weeks. And one of the things that Ken did, and he was sort of a master at the media, was he kept telling the government that there would be a complete and total occupation of the site. And so they didn't know what that meant. And that they had, you know, they spent nearly $1 million in police and National Guard force, not to quell any kind of violence, but simply because they had no idea what we would do. But
Occupy Warren County, 1978. You're
but
way
our
ahead of
occupation
your time.
Was a spiritual one. Yeah. And we knew that when you take the high road, you win people over. And we did. And little by little, as we proved it the first week and the second week, in came Dr. Lowry, in came Congressman Fauntroy, in came lawyers and people from the outside and around the state and beyond, because they saw that we had a point. We were holding the people to a really respectful way of doing civil disobedience. And I think that's part of why we're known for having launched the environmental justice movement and for having transformed environmentalism, because we had civil rights concerns, black and white people who had, you know, it had been Sierra Club and that had been a, quote, white organization's interest in terms of environment. But no, we had children, old people, young people, blacks, whites,
Native Americans,
unemployed, employed. We had everybody.
And it was an educational effort. That was its purpose.
Really. People knew. People showed up. It went on for weeks. There were arrests, and yet the site was built.
Oh, yes, it was built.
One thing that we got out of this public media event was national attention, including the Washington Post, said it was the marriage of environmental concerns with civil rights. And it was after that that we got a promise from the governor in a full-page letter that we all read in the jail yard that day that said that when and if the technology ever became feasible, he would detoxify this landfill. Because we kept telling them, you can detoxify these PCBs, we hoped, along the roadside. Or they could be taken to a facility where they could be detoxified. But all of that was still in, you know, new stages, because these were all new regulations.
And was there another site that was deemed suitable, but I think it was in Alabama, and it would have been pretty expensive.
Yeah, I need to address that issue because, again, I've been thought of as a NIMBY, and I wasn't thinking that way. The state in 1978 indicated that there was a possibility they would look into the the waste facility in Emile, Alabama. Talking to our soil scientist about that, He said, "Well, Ken, you know, I'd feel a whole lot better when you're dealing with a, you know, with a situation where you've got something like 600 feet of heavy clay between the base of the landfill and groundwater, as opposed to what we have in Warren County." And of course, at that time in 1978, I knew nothing about landfills, and so I thought, well, if it's federally approved and it's in a state, it's probably a safe landfill. It was only later that I found out that none of them really are safe in the long run. So I did mention the Alabama option, but I did close it. I did close out anything like an offsite possibility when I wrote the 5-point framework that that led to the resolution to the problem.
I was going to say, Frank, after we had that huge public hearing that sort of awakened the state and the EPA that this was not going to just happen easily, I went with the delegation to the governor. And Governor Hunt is the one who mentioned the Alabama option. He said if we do not find an option in North Carolina, it's an option because it was a hazardous facility where they brought all kinds of waste, including PCBs. It's a sad story to hear, but the people there in that community are also poisoned now. And 40 years after they built that, it's leaking into their community. So there really isn't a good answer through landfilling.
We'll talk about that site in Warren County now and the future of the environmental justice movement when our conversation with Ken and Deborah Ferruccio continues on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. We're talking this hour about environmental justice, a movement in a sense begun by Deborah and Ken Ferruccio in Warren County beginning in 1978. As we said, that site was built. The PCBs were buried there. The state got the waivers it looked for, but then promised that it would be safe anyway. Tell us about the site that was actually built.
Frank, they built the PCB landfill on a marginal piece of property with the idea that their landfill design could compensate for the fact that the clays were not going to hold back the chemicals and also that the fact that the groundwater was going to be right at the bottom of the landfill. In fact, since the regulations were then dropped built in waivers, they never did build the one thing that was absolutely critical to a dry tomb landfill, and that's called a leachate collection system. We never knew exactly why they didn't build that, but my guess is that they didn't build it because if they had gone any deeper to build it, they would have hit the groundwater.
What is that? So it's called a dry tomb, which is the name of this particular kind of waste site.
Nothing getting in and nothing getting out is dry tomb. The theory is that the backup systems that they call them, the leachate collection systems and so forth, would even if they got out of the landfill, the monitoring wells and so forth would detect it, given that it was being monitored. But theoretically, nothing getting into the landfill, nothing leaving the landfill, and the irony is that they capped it with almost 1 million gallons of water in it, or so they say. I rather suspect that that came later. But what happened is the crisis was declared in 1993. That, hey, you know, you got a problem there. There's about 750,000 gallons of water threatening to breach the bottom liner, and we've got to do something about it. I remembered what Deborah had mentioned earlier, that the state had promised in 1982 that they would detoxify the landfill given the feasibility of detoxification. And so what I did is I shifted the basis, originally the idea was to prove that the site was leaking. So basically there was a shift from that idea to the idea of, well, if we can show technical feasibility, let's help to keep the state keep its promise. Five-point framework did just that. It basically was detoxification-centered. It was agreeable to the state. It was agreeable to the county. And the idea that if we could meet the objectives stated in the framework, we could approximate something like a return of the site, an approximation of what it was prior to the opening of the landfill through detoxification, and achieve, you know, something analogous to my view of detoxification. Environmental justice, which for Warren County would be the restoration of the environment prior to the opening of the landfill.
Frank, I was going to say, if we can back up a second, not only did they build the landfill and cap it with water, a dry tomb landfill still is the landfill design that is the design used in all landfills in the United States. It is still the Cadillac quote. It's still the state of the art. It's the best they still have. Ours was built and it failed from day one. And by the end of the movement, which was late October, by that next spring, the state had already realized after the top eroded off of it, there were gullies, it blew up in bubbles so that they had to pop, you know, PVC pipes in to let out the toxic methane gas. Their plan was to try to pump the water out from the landfill to put it through a filtration system and then spray it back onto the landfill, which made no sense to us. We were incensed. So,
they were contradicting the premise.
They contradicted their premise. And so, of course, to keep a movement going is very difficult. So that next spring, Ken and a couple people who understood this, they were with an alliance from Washington, D.C. They went over to the state, to the site when the state was going to begin pumping, and they removed the pump from the contractor's truck and just set it aside. They didn't leave the property. They were then arrested for felonious larceny. Ken went to jail. He fasted in jail for 3 weeks. Dr. Lowry came back. And the whole point of his doing this was to say, look, not only is this bad, but look how quickly it's bad. You know, it was bad from the beginning. And we found out later from independent scientists who were searching the state files that within several months, the EPA found that there were significant PCB air emissions as far as a half a mile away. Mm-hmm. So we knew we had air emissions from the beginning of the roadside spills. The Department of Agriculture issued warnings, don't eat anything or graze your cattle within 100 yards because the people's vegetables were turning black. So we've always dealt with the water because water's underground. We can argue about it, and the water may go through this monitoring, past this monitoring well. But the air is, you know, the air pollution is immediate. So our goal then and continues to be to keep pressing to show that as long as we use poor, minority, or other communities to dump on, we give industry a green light to keep producing this stuff with impunity because it's cheap. Landfills are the cheapest way they can get rid of things.
Have we been able to measure the actual damage done by all of the leakage since that site was put in?
No, we haven't, because it's going to cost a lot of money. Yeah. When we first got the state to even come back to the drawing board and think about a cleanup, we had money from the Episcopal Diocese who was supporting us as we were trying to stop these massive sub-D landfills all over. And we said, we're going to prove our landfill is leaking. And that 2 days later, that's when the state announced there was water in the landfill. We needed to do something. We had $3,200 in a small grant, one sample, to find out if you have dioxins is 3,000 something. So, no, we haven't done that because, of course, that's why they put them in poor communities. You don't have the resources, legal, scientific, and otherwise, to do that. But we've gone on. We don't wait for the government to prove that something is bad for us because they will study it. They'll do 700 pages of a dioxin reassessment, and then they'll reassess their reassessment, and then they will come up with inconclusive by design. And so we just know that we have to go straight down the middle and deal with the people and the facts and the truth and common sense, and they listen.
Well, they're willing to shortcut the science and shortcut all the research when it comes to putting it in. It seems to me that it was on an awfully fast track. Not a lot of research was being done when they decided to put the dump there. Now, they weren't researching it to death then. I mean, again, it sort of brings to mind, if we can come forward to 2011, the whole question of fracking, where we're being told that it's plenty safe, don't worry about it. Let's just get these things put in. Is there a parallel, do you think?
Oh, my gosh. I heard on Diane Rehm the other day, they were asking the question to somebody on the panel, well, do you really think that the companies that are fracking should have to reveal what chemicals they're using as they inject them way down into the earth and put all this water with it? You know, I'm driving along going, oh, my gosh, how can you ask such a stupid question? Of course we should have to know, because if we can inject horrible chemicals down into groundwater and we don't even know what they are, then of course who's liable for them and what can we do anyway to mitigate them? So,
and how can we establish cause and effect when you have contamination?
And you don't know what's in there, or you haven't been told what's in there. And then again, the government's able to waive certain regulations and then not abide by the plan that they put into effect, mm-hmm. or that they mm-hmm. told you.
Exactly.
So what about now? What's happening there today?
Well, there's a movement, futurists and so forth. There is a need to move from the industrial model to a model of sustainability. And here I should say something about Vance Granville Community College and the community college system. The president of Wilson Community College, Rusty Stevens, he visited us at Vance Granville and really juxtaposed for us two models, the industrial model and what he calls the sustainability model. And he argued for the need of a paradigm shift as moving from one to the other. The sustainability model means simply that, you know, concerning the production process, what goes in the production process comes out of the production process clean from cradle to grave, basically. And that seems like an incredible aspiration, but I think that is the direction that we have to move into, because simply presently we're producing products that generate toxic hazardous and nuclear waste, and we put the waste in waste management facilities and then cycle that waste back into the environment. And so in a sense, we're consuming ourselves and consuming these products and contributing to the pervasive contamination of the globe. And that simply is not sustainable. And so we do have to move toward a sustainability model.
And in specific, what are we doing? What is our community? What can we do? I was just listening to a piece about a writer, Jeremy Rifkin, and it's about how lateral thinking, lateral power, people power is going to be changing the economy, the environment, and all of these, as we know, are very tied. And he's got a plan which I don't know a whole lot about yet, but it's being tried with in San Antonio and Rome, and bringing sustainable ways of making energy house to house. So there are some models. But what he said the other day was, when somebody called and they said, well, Mr. Rifkin, how do we make this happen? He goes, you know, we have to get America with the vision it used to have. Americans used to have this narrative, and the narrative was all about how the future can become better. We're losing that narrative, and we're becoming like, oh, my gosh, the world's going down. What are we going to do? Oh, there's nothing to do. So our part in Warren County is that we're going to share this narrative. I've written a book, and I'm going to keep telling this narrative, because what's inside of the North Carolina PCB story, the Warren County North Carolina PCB story, is how a citizenry can do something, and how even the poorest of the poor can not only do it, but do it well when they stay focused on the issues, they keep the facts in front of them, and they stand arm in arm together.
Well, you have to forgive me, because the organization is great. You pulled people together and you linked two groups that clearly had not been together politically before, but the dump went in. The waste site went in. Is there a victory here?
I think there's a victory in this sense that, again, as we've been seeing, and again, if we learned nothing else from the Warren County experience, again, we learned that how difficult it is to solve these environmental waste management problems in a democratic way. Once I wrote that 5-point framework, and focused it on basically what would be a win-win for both sides. Both sides could work together and test detoxification, and then if that would work, we could approximate some measure of returning the site to what it was before the opening of the landfill. But my point is that was a democratic process. We had folks at the state level, we had folks at the county level working together to achieve that common objective of environmental justice for Warren County. So I think when you look at the whole story, again, Eileen McGurdy says that, we transformed environmentalism. But when you look at the whole story, basically it took everybody that was involved in that process to transform environmentalism, to set the precedent for citizen participation. Couldn't have done that without the state. We couldn't have done that without state officials helping us get the money to detoxify the landfill.
And tell us about the detoxification effort. Where are we on that right now? Is that feasible?
It's done. No. They used what they call basic catalyzed decomposition. It was detoxified. There are concerns about whether or not the cleanup standards were as stringent as they needed to be, and there are those kinds of questions.
And that detoxification clearly is an outcome from this kind of organization. It's something that they wouldn't have embarked, they wouldn't have researched, and certainly spent the time and money on had there not been.
They were happy. The state was happy to do it, I think, because they had promised the people of Owen County that they would detoxify, given the technical feasibility of detoxification. So the way I framed it, I said, let's help the state keep its promise to the people of Warren County. And then the Secretary of Health and Natural Resources, Environment, sent me a letter telling me that the state was in agreement with all 5 points. So we had something there that could, the synthesis. We had the thesis, we had the antithesis, we needed the synthesis. And that really was more of a democratic process. And so I thought that was a victory.
In terms of victories that people might not have understood at the time, there's something like in 1977, there was something like 900 million PCB-carrying, capacity-carrying containers, transformers all over the United States. And so with these new regulations, this PCB landfill was only 5 acres, the actual landfill. It was 142 acres, and they had property adjacent they could get. So this would have become an ongoing PCB landfill for all the PCBs around the United States, probably the world if they wanted to. And one of the things that we did as we responded through those 4 years of arduous due process is we got the governor to say, okay, it'll be only for the roadside PCBs. What's more, at the same time, the very week that it was announced that they were going to put this PCB landfill in Warren County, the state must have decided they were going to go for the whole thing. And we found out our officials had been flown to the Emile, Alabama site because they were trying to talk our county into hosting another massive facility. Because, see, Warren County was the richest county in the state because of its location between Raleigh and Richmond. And it was targeted for waste because of its location between the south and the northeast, the shipping from the coast.
And when you say richest, had been the richest.
It had been
richest.
The richest, excuse me.
Yeah, in the past.
Right, and so the point is location, first of all.
Let me ask you this, and I've only got about a minute left, but whether or not you see the environmental justice movement as a kind of point on the line now as we look at the occupation movement that's, again, a fiercely democratically looking movement. Is that in the genealogy of environmental justice, do you think?
I think so. And I don't know as much about it as I know this. I've been immersed in this for many, many years. But I do know that economic justice and environmental justice are tied together. And the one thing that Warren County did as a victory for everyone was we said, and this was a poor community that could easily compromise and said, bring the industry in, bring it in. We need the jobs. We'll do it. We said, no, we hold the line. We will not compromise our future for the benefit of today. And so our message is that as we look to answer the economic crisis that we're in and begin to solve it, we can't solve it by deregulating and taking away regulations and protections that barely protect us anyway. We certainly need them, and we need them to be more stringent.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Real pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you for having us, Frank.
Thank you, Frank.
Deborah and Ken Ferruccio, teachers at Vance Granville Community College. They were instrumental in fighting the development of the Warren County PCB landfill in the late 70s and helped to launch the environmental justice movement. To learn more about them, you can go to ncpcbarchives.com. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.